Radio Show with your host, Lonnie Clark. We stand together and accept that we now live in a world transformed by Fukushima. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time here on UCY.TV Radio. We relentlessly engage every ear that listens. We expose and confront the complete lack of accountability for the nuclear industry. Consider social engineering programs who view our bodies, minds, and souls as assets on a balance sheet. We discuss vital current issues, interview activists, and engage our audience in an effort to allow all voices to be heard. The Age of Vision Radio Show creates a venue that all will choose. We encourage our listeners to reclaim their power and their courage to take action and save our planet from the ravages of greed and indifference. Our actions matter. Every voice matters. We remind our listeners that happiness is resistance. Love is greater than fear.
Good morning, UCY.TV radio listeners. This is Lonnie Clark with the Age of Fission radio show. Thank you for joining us. We are approaching the end of the year. I cannot believe it. It's already November 2nd, 2016, and it's 8 o'clock in the morning on a Wednesday. And thank you for joining us. And as you know, on Wednesdays, we do interviews on this radio show or attempt to. Today, we have a returning guest, a friend of our show, and a friend to everybody in this country, actually. And that's Donna Gilmore from SantaOnofreeSafety.org, and I really want to thank you, Donna, for joining us. Welcome back.
Okay, thank you. It's my pleasure, and I have important information to share with people. A lot of things, it's hard to know where to start. People are familiar with the Department of Energy. It has recently finished their getting public input on what they call consent-based siting. They want to create an interim storage facility, one or more, to take the nuclear waste that's sitting at initially decommissioned plants. The waste is currently stored in what I call Chernobyl cans. They're thin-walled stainless steel canisters, each containing more cesium-137 than was released from Chernobyl, and that these containers, the canisters, have been found to have potential cracking issues, but can't even be inspected for cracks because nobody can get close to them because of the radiation inside and the thin wall canister. They want to take these canisters. They don't know if they're cracking or not. They haven't been in use long enough to start leaking or exploding, but we're starting to get close to that time period. And they're talking about taking these, transporting them across the rails to some undetermined
By rails,
location.
You mean trains?
Trains, yes.
Right.
Yeah, they're too heavy. They've started putting so much spent fuel, which is highly probably the most radioactive material that man has ever made. They want to take this and transport it by rail to some other part of the country.
Also now, in half-inch thick containers in the same half-inch.
Well, what they would do is it would stay in the same containers. But then they put it, they have, because it's so thin, it doesn't protect, and the way they're made, they don't protect from all kinds of radiation, so they have to be, those containers have to, they call them canisters, they have to be put inside a thick metal cask called a transport cask, with a bolted lid on it. These, the thin canisters are welded shut, so they don't even know what's going on inside. have no way to inspect, and there's issues that, you know, I don't want to take too much time on that, but there's potential issues where these spent fuel, they call them spent fuel assemblies that are inside, if the structure that's holding them fails, you could actually have a criticality. You know, they start banging into each other. Anyway,
yeah,
they want to take.
I'm looking at your website, and there's a picture of the canister on its side, and it looks like a waffle grid, right? So
yeah,
one of those squares, they put a rod, correct?
Well, they don't put it. Okay, I might as well explain this now. Yeah. All right, the uranium pellets, the radioactive material. The uranium pellets, they're about, each is about the size of a pencil eraser. They're put inside these metal rods made out of a zircaloy metal. And they put a whole bunch of them together, and they call that an assembly. So they take a whole bunch of rods, bundle them together as one assembly, so they call them fuel assemblies. So that, and so each of those holes in that look like a basket there with separate little pockets. Each of those holes holds it in one assembly, and that structure, most of them, that metal structure you're seeing, that basket, most of them are made out of aluminum. And Japan has recently banned the use of aluminum baskets because they have found that they're not going to last long enough.
Your website says not even 60 years.
Not even 60 years, yeah. I have raised this issue with the NRC and with Southern California Edison, that's down near San Onofre here, that manages San Onofre and owns it. I've gotten no answers back on that issues. I mean, the United States has designed these containers in a way that they can't even be inspected on the outside, let alone the inside. So their whole design assumes nothing's going to go wrong, except the NRC now admits that these canisters, the stainless steel can start cracking. They've admitted that, and the Cobourg nuclear plant that the NRC considers has a comparable container. It's a waste tank, but it's a water tank, but it's made of the same materials and
now,
the same manufacturing.
Where is the Cobourg?
That's in South Africa. It's located right by the ocean, and it had through wall cracks. Leaked in only 17 years of use. And that tank is thicker than the thickness of the U.S. thin wall canisters.
Now, are these the canisters they're using at Fukushima? Or are they the old ones that we
No, no. At Fukushima, fortunately, at Fukushima, they use thick wall cast. Most of the rest of the world, we're kind of unique. Most of the rest of the world uses thick wall cast. They're 10 to almost 20 inches thick. The wall of the container is almost 10 to 20 inches thick. Okay, I think the ones at Fukushima are around 10 inches, but I'm not exactly sure of what the thickness measurement is. I don't recall off the top of my head. I have specifications, some specifications from TEPCO, which is the person, which is the company that is the one that manages that. So, and in Germany, they're almost 20 inches thick. The ones the Germans make are almost 20 inches thick. They're different metals. The ones the rest of the world is using, they can be inspected, maintained, repaired, and monitored to prevent radiation leaks. In the United States, the over 2,000 thin wall canisters that we already have and building more every year doesn't meet any of those requirements. We will only know there's a problem after it leaks radiation into the environment. And the president of one of the major companies that makes these thin cans said, and I have this, we have this on video, I have it on San Onofre Safety, I have it on video, where he says that even if you could find a crack, even a microscopic through-wall crack will release millions of curies of radiation into the environment. And wow. Due to the nature of stainless steel, even if you could find it, and even if you could find a way to repair it, which would have to be robotically because you can't even get close to it, which they don't even have that invented, he said it's not feasible to repair them because it just introduces another area for corrosion and cracking. Stainless steel has some unique properties from other metals. And the thing is, once a crack starts in stainless steel, it has a unique infrastructure that once a crack starts, it grows on its own and it continues to grow on its own. So it's like once a crack's there, it's kind of like a lit fuse. It's just going to go, and we don't know when it's going to go off. The NRC will admit to once a crack is there, it could grow through the wall in 16 years.
Donna, now the Coburg. Can I ask you a question on all of this? This is
sure.
The attitude. Now, I've heard this from actually Chuck Johnson from Physicians for Social Responsibility, and I are going to discuss this next time we talk on the radio. His attitude, and I think this is of the NRC's attitude, is that the dilution is the solution to the pollution, that like there is just Fukushima is just not impacting the planet or our environment because the ocean is just way too big, that even if San Onofre, everything at San Onofre cracked and fell out into the environment, yes, it would cause Southern California an immediate issue, but it's not a worldwide catastrophe. It would not affect that much.
Ask Chuck, how many, we've got over 2,000 of these canisters installed. They most have been installed less than a decade, okay? It's probably going to take around 17 to 20 years before we start seeing leaks. And they have no method, nothing in place to deal with. Once it leaks, they've got no plan. They've got nothing in place to deal with it, period, which is a huge concern, you know. Is he saying that a Chernobyl's worth of radiation?
Well, he's saying that the radiation
that was released from Chernobyl. Chernobyl's radiation traveled around the Northern Hemisphere. In Finland, which isn't in Russia, which isn't in the Ukraine, in Finland, you know, once that contaminates an area, it doesn't go away. It's basically into eternity with this material. In Finland, they can no longer eat reindeer because the mushrooms that grow there are contaminated.
Still,
you know,
to this day.
Yes, still to this day. The stuff doesn't go away. Yeah, you want to get as far away as you can, reducing your odds for sure. But how many Chernobyls can go off in this country before Chuck's going to say this is a problem?
Right. I don't know. That's the conversation we're going to have because I said to him, you know what, 3 years ago when I met Chuck, I could accept it. Fukushima had been going on about 2 years at that point. But now we have, I mean, it's over, 5 billion tons of radioactive waste. But then when you look at what's happened at Sellafield, I mean, although what they're not addressing is the massive die-off in the oceans that we're having. I mean, all you have to do is go to the... So I'm just wondering if the NRC's
here's the thing. Here would be my question for Chuck, and it sounds like Chuck and I need to have a call. When's your next call with him?
Actually, next Wednesday we'll be talking.
Okay, well, I will make an attempt to have a conversation with him beforehand and see. I'll call Chuck. I know Chuck. I've met with him. We had lunch.
He's a good guy. I think he's on the right side of the issue, but I think he's
The thing is, there's so much misinformation. Even with people with good intentions and even the people at the highest level that have been fighting a lot of nuclear stuff, there's some information that they are misinformed about. For example, none of the ones that I've spoken to or I'm aware of, and I've spoken to a lot of them, They were not aware about the spin canister problem. The only reason I'm aware of it is because I was asked to listen in to an NRC technical meeting, which I had really never done before. And at these are public meetings. Anybody can listen in. They go on daily. Anybody can listen in. Most people don't.
Do you have to make an appointment to listen in?
No. You can just call in.
I did not.
You go to the NRC. Okay. You go to the NRC.gov website. Right on the home page, they have a calendar. And, you know, pick a day, and it'll tell you what public meetings there's going to be. And by public, I mean what they're public, because that's the law. And a lot of these meetings are where the vendors, the vendors for the CAFs, for
it
the reactor
says public
part,
meeting schedule.
And utilities, they talk, this is where they talk about issues that are unresolved issues, okay? And the NRC technical staff are at these meetings. They have a lot of good people at the NRC at the working level. The BS starts once you get into management, you know. But at these working levels, they share a lot of things that are problems that they're trying to figure out. And the one I listened into, they said, well, gee, we didn't think these things were going to have problems, you know, for 100 years. Now they're finding out that there could be short-term leaks in these canisters. So, gee, maybe we need to figure out a way where we can inspect for cracks, you know.
Well, let me ask you this, because I went to this public calendar meeting, and it gives the phone, the contact is John Vera, but no phone number to call in. So this is not one that's open to the public.
They've gotten better about putting in what they call bridge lines and passcodes, but they're not perfect. So if there's, and if you pick the thing that says more, you go to it, you find it. And they'll mm-hmm. give you an announcement,
yeah.
and usually there are things that say more. If you click on that, sometimes there'll be a document, either the more or the meeting info, one of those two.
Do we
there'll
click
be
on
an
media
agenda.
Feedback form? We have to have media feedback form?
Not that. It'll, okay. At the top it says meeting info, and then down, and then just below the little paragraph it says more.
Uh-huh.
Let me see which one of those. And if it has an agenda, a lot of times it will include
a call
the code
number.
To call in. If it doesn't, it will give you the email, and you just send an email to that person telling them that you would like the code, and I also recommend asking for any copies of any presentation material, because then you can follow along with the PowerPoint.
I see, and so it has like a little telephone. I'm looking at it where what I'm doing is, as you say this, I'm doing, because I've done this a couple times. You've encouraged us to go here, and then I go to this, and I get very confused about how, and I think they do this intentionally. I think I'm like the perfect subject. On the first one that I see here, it has one contacting John Vera with the phone number. We don't contact John Vera, do we? We call and ask for the teleconference number.
No. You contact whoever's in charge of that particular meeting.
Okay.
The contact person for the meeting.
And we call them before the meeting and ask them.
Yeah, I would just send them an email. Usually, okay. You know. Yeah, so usually you can find the email on
the
meeting on the meeting notice. They most of them have gotten better about putting the code there, but not all of them are doing it. So, but usually you'll get same day that you put in. I do this all the time. I say, could you please send me the call-in number and any PowerPoint or presentation material. And usually the same day or the next day, they'll send it to me.
For example, today there's one, I guess it says this is a long period of time, 8:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. It's a
well. Here's the thing: nobody wants to devote their life to listening to NRC technical meetings. So my suggestion would be, look at the subject, and okay, there's so much wrong with what's going on. And no one person can deal with all of it.
Right.
And you'd be overwhelmed. So So, you know, be cognizant of how much time you have available and where's the best use of your time. So, for example, this one you're talking about, Korea is trying to get a new power reactor approved, an advanced power reactor 1400. They're trying to get NRC certification to build this. Maybe you don't want that built, but is that something you want to spend your time on? Is that something you're actually going to take some action on?
I get what
you're saying. If not, just skip that one and find one that may be more relevant to, you know, to what you care about or something that you can
maybe do something about. I get what you're
saying.
So it's really important to go through the schedule of the meeting, pick your battles, because you're going to have to stick with that battle to be effective.
Yeah, I think the key is you want to stay focused. I mean,
single one of our listeners could go to this thing at the calendar here and open up the public meeting schedule and just pick your battle and just choose one item and be like white on rice with these people and be like that annoying little gnat that won't go away.
Well, no, unfortunately, the NRC is what they call a captured organization. And so, you're not going to get, if you're trying to change what they do, I would say, you know, that's probably a losing battle. But what you can do is you can learn what's going on. You can get black and white solid evidence of the facts, because this is where you get the details, and this is how I built a lot of the information you see on Fentanyl for Safety. It came out of listening into these meetings, and then by then I follow up with research. Once I know what the issue is, like I didn't know what the heck stress corrosion cracking meant relates to stainless steel. So once I knew the problem, then I could do some, you know, Google searches and find other documentation about the issue and learn more. So, some of the things I've been able to do is I've been able to, like, for example, San Onofre wanted to use a certain canister to store the waste, and I learned enough about the issues. I was able to submit comments to the NRC. They give the public like 30 days for most things, you know, unless we get some significant comments, this is approved. Okay. So I submitted comments. It was apparently sufficient enough that they pulled it from approval. Mm-hmm. And so I've had like three for three, I think. I've submitted comments on three different ones. I got some help from Diane Curran on how to approach this, and she helped with the first one, and I did the other two on my own. And it was significant enough that they actually pulled those from approval. So I bought like almost a year's delay before Edison could do anything in San Onofre. And then they actually put some things in writing. Like, for example, they only approve the storage containers for 20 years, okay? And I made comments about the fact that these have to last more than 20 years. You're not dealing with any aging issues in these containers. And they put in their response. They have a written response. They eventually approve these canisters. You know, they approve everything the industry wants, pretty much, eventually. And in their approval, they said, well, we only look at 20 years. We don't look at any aging issues that might occur after 20 years.
Why did they only pick 20 years? How'd they come up with that number?
They're a captured agency.
Wow.
They're a captured agency, okay? The nuclear industry is really captured it, and the nuclear industry has one priority, and that's money. That's profit for their stockholders, for themselves.
Well, listen,
that's all they care about.
Well, this is the language they use. There's a meeting I picked on November 8th just to kind of see, as you were talking, okay, let me pick an idea. Because, you know, I always read these NRC alerts, and we're always having pipes exploding. So there's a meeting that says this: the purpose of this meeting is to provide the BWROG FBOT committee an opportunity to update the NRC staff on their efforts with the application of finite break opening time in place of instantaneous pipe separation for a specific evaluation of various GE Hitachi Nuclear Energy LOCA acoustic load safety communications. Now, does that sound like English to you to try to figure out what the heck they're talking about?
But it's no, but you know, the on this particular one, there's a bridge phone number to call in and a passcode. This one has it on there, by the way.
Yes, I see that. That's why I picked it. Because
Here's the thing. You can always email or talk to the contact person ahead of time and say, what is this all about? Or another thing you can do is look at some of these keywords and then do a Google search, and a lot of times you'll find documents related to this, so there's a couple of different ways to go at it. But yeah, it's a good idea to probably find out ahead of time what the heck this means, but you know it's talking about pipes breaking.
Right, exactly. So, that's the part we...
Yeah, so you know it's important. But,
right.
Yeah, but if, you know, the thing is... You have an opportunity here. The contact name is usually a technical person, okay? It's not until they get to management that the BS really starts, okay? So you're likely to get, you know, some honest answers, and they can be very helpful, you know? And the thing is that the NRC, they have what's called a chilled work environment. That means that employees are afraid to report safety problems or afraid maybe to speak up for fear of retaliation or affecting their promotions, you know, whatever, okay? And so in some ways, you can be a voice for these employees. I mean, they may want to share some information. A lot of them are happy to share information with you. You know, they're glad to see the public paying attention. Maybe it'll help.
Because then at least somebody, they can give you the information that they feel comfortable giving you, and then you can take the ball and run with it. And it, like, for example, what you did with these canisters, there had to have been people within the organization that knew these things were a disaster, but
well,
could not
speak
up.
That's who I learned it from. Daryl Dunn. The problem is I've been effective enough with this that I think he's taken some heat, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But he did some excellent... He's a corrosion engineer. And after I asked a bunch of questions in that first meeting, I called him up afterwards to talk to him. And he freely, you know, spoke to me and told me some things. He said, well, you know, the thing is that the other examples of the cracking, those containers are not as hot as our containers. And if you have cracks, if your container is hotter, those cracks will grow faster.
Wow.
You know, so he shared that. Well, eventually when his director of spent fuel management, Mark Lombard, found out that I was talking to his staff, he's directed them not to talk to me anymore.
Really?
So, yes, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, he wants me to go through him on everything. But when I talk to him, he gives me a bunch of bureaucratic BS and doesn't answer my questions. So, it's,
wow.
You know, yeah. But I do have him on. I do have Mark Lombard on video. He's the one that's responsible for approving these inferior containers. Even, you know, the NRC approves storage canisters and transport canisters for nuclear waste for everybody, even for the DOE. Now, nothing stops a utility from using better quality products. Nothing really stops the DOE from buying better quality products. The NRC has a very low standard because of the influence of the nuclear industry, you know. But usually these utilities, I mean, Prairie Island's an exception. They bought thick caps. I think they're about 10 inches thick. They have bolted lids. They have a monitoring system that will alert well ahead of any kind of leak. They don't have the cracking problem. They can be totally inspected. You can get next to them. They're made out of carbon steel with some kind of an epoxy exterior that can be maintained. The lids are bolted, so they have metal seals, or there's a problem with the seal, as long as the outer seal you can replace. So they're, you know, so they're using something better. It costs more. These canisters, they cost, the thin canister system is made up of the thin metal canister plus, they put them in a, what they call a concrete overpack or a concrete cask, to protect from neutron and gamma rays, because the thin one doesn't protect from that. And it sits on a pad. The whole system, and there's some other parts, but I don't want to take up the time going into that level of detail. The whole system, the price is up to about $4 million a piece now, counting labor. $4 million for each one of these. Now, the NRC has been claiming that it's like $750,000, but their information is based on really old data. The price has just gone crazy on these things. So, and then the thicker ones, if you get the thick ones like Prairie Island had, they were almost $6 million a piece with the, you know, the whole thing, labor materials. The thing is, if the thin ones are going to fail starting in, say, 20 years, they're going to end up costing you more, you know, let alone plus the disaster. I don't, you know, that's a whole other issue. But just you can make a cost-based case. Now, states have total jurisdiction over cost issues. The NRC is not their jurisdiction cost, only safety. That's their only, what their charge is legally.
The NRC, their only charge is safety.
That's their only charge.
Don't you think they're failing 100%?
Well, of course. Yeah, of course they have, you know. But as long as we have a Congress, and in the past, I'll give you an example of what Dave Lockbaum, the Union Concerned Scientist, he told me this story, and it was written up in a newspaper article, and I talked to him about it after I read the article. Years ago, when the NRC commissioners were starting to do their job and put safety before industry profits, they were threatened by one of the Senate. The Senate oversees the NRC's budget. They threatened to cut their budget 40% if they didn't play nice with the nuclear industry.
And wow, 40%.
The president appoints the five NRC commissioners that are controlling our destiny. However, all five of those have to be confirmed by the Senate. And the Senate will not confirm any that don't put industry profits over safety. That's just the reality. Now, maybe some of these senators, they believe whatever the nuclear industry vendors tell them, you know. But who's telling those senators the truth? Who's telling the president the truth? Who has access to them that's providing them the truth about really what's going on with waste storage? I haven't found anybody. I spoke to the former NRC chairman face-to-face just a month or so ago, and she did not know, former Chairman McFarland, she did not know about the cracking problems with these canisters and that they couldn't be inspected even on the outside. She did not know that.
Wow.
And I spoke to John Kotek. He's the assistant to the deputy to Moniz, one of them. And he did not know the problems with these thin canisters. And his chief deputy over everything to do with the fuel cycle, including storage, that was Andy Griffith. He didn't believe me at first when I told him they couldn't even be inspected on the outside. He didn't believe me at first. He said, well, that can't be true because they have to be. He did not know it either. But he does now. I gave him the evidence, and now he knows, and we've had some regular calls, and I have a different level of relationship with him. But, you know, what now that he has the information, what can he do with it? Even if he wanted to. I don't know what he wants to do. He's supposed to be developing a report to respond to all my comments that I sent to him about the issues with the canisters, and he's promised that he's going to do that. But, you know, who's really in charge of the DOE? Is Andy Griffiths not in charge? John Kotek's not in charge? Is Moniz calling the shots?
I mean, the DOE is run by the industrial military complex. Let's just be clear.
But who? I mean, Moniz is appointed by the president, right?
Well, it's the deep state running our country. That's really the issue here, Donna.
Number one, if the truth isn't out there about these canisters, I mean, I'm sitting here, you know, 5 miles from San Onofre, and based on when they started loading in 2003, these things have been sitting by the ocean. They could be cracking right now, and nobody knows. I figure maybe I've got 4 years before the risk goes up that one of these could actually leak, you know. And I keep asking Edison, what's your plan for that? And they have not given me anything back. And I talked to the NRC. I said, hey, they're talking about that if they have a canister leak, they're going to put it inside another container. They call it an overpack. They're going to put one inside the other like a Russian doll.
Wow.
Effect. And I asked Mark Lombard of the NRC. He's, you know, I said, I can't find any technical space specifications on such a container. I don't even understand how it worked because these thin canisters are so hot when they put them in those in the concrete overpacks or casts. Now they have air vents in them so that the heat can get out. So it's not a closed system. So how can you take this thin canister that's leaking radiation, put it inside another container? Wouldn't it overheat if you don't have the vents? And you can't have the vents because you're trying to stop the radiation. You know, I mean, what they're, you know, what Edison is claiming that they'll do, doesn't make technical sense. And when I talked to Mark Lombard about it, he says, well, no vendor has approached us to even discuss with us having that kind of a container for a leaking canister, no, let alone submit an application for such a cap container.
Hmm. Wow, this is the thing. Like they actually do understand the gravity of the situation, don't they? In their hearts, they do know it.
Well, you know, here's what Mark Lombard says to me. Okay, he says, Donna, you worry too much. You know, if there's any problems, they'll figure it out. They always do. So he's like, magical thinking, you know. And I said, well, hey, look at the Department of Energy. You've got leaking containers at Hanford, Savannah River. I mean, you got leaking containers all over the place for, you know, other kinds of nuclear waste. And he goes, oh, well, that's the Department of Energy. We're a lot better than them. You know, that was his ridiculous statement to me. And they're not better, because I've researched what's going on at Hanford, Savannah River, and now, you know, the Rocky Flats, is there some good YouTube videos out on that one. These are defense plants that built nuclear bombs, and it results in a lot of waste. And what these facilities all have in common is they're using inferior containers to hold the nuclear waste.
They know they're doing that.
I wrote to the state of Washington. They have a whole branch or division that does nothing but have some kind of review of Hanford, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked about their, you know, what kind of containers they're using. Can you give me some specifications for them? And anyway, to make a long story short, I eventually found the specifications. And guess what? They're using thin wall metal with no way to adequately inspect or monitor the containers. And they will only know after they leak radiation, which is exactly what's happened at Hanford. They went from single wall tanks at Hanford, because it's kind of liquid waste or sludge waste there, the military waste. They went from single wall ones that leaked, and all they did was they picked double wall ones, but they were still thin metal, so geez, surprise! It went right through one of the layers of the thin metal, and they, you know, so they have a big mess. And so, I mean, the bottom line is, you want a nuclear waste storage canister that meets the same requirements that you would have in a car. You don't need to be a nuclear physicist to understand this basic requirement. And this is the way I would approach city councils and state government officials and the general public. Would you buy a car that you couldn't inspect, maintain, repair, and had no early warning system to let you know that a critical part was going to fail? Would you buy that car?
Right. This is a cost factor. Like, what's the cheap container cost as opposed to like a one that actually really works? What's the differential in the initial cost?
It's not a straightforward answer. The thin ones, the system is about $4 million for each canister and overpack, and that's this material and labor cost. Labor cost is almost as much, or about as much, as the material cost. The French, there's really only two major companies making the thick wall ones. That they're either German or French design. The French ones are about $6 million, and they're about 10 inches. Thick, mainly carbon steel, and they have some lead and other things. And the German ones, now the German ones might be cheaper, and I was dealing with the manufacturer of the German ones, and, you know, he said he could meet the cost of the thin ones, but I don't have that in writing, so I'm not going to the bank with that at all. You know, I don't quote anything as fact if I don't have, you know, hard data to back it up. Edison down here, we managed to get them to talk to the company that makes the German canisters. So they were saying a lot of bad information that wasn't true about the German cast, and I managed to dispel that. I found hard evidence from Sandia Lab and other sources that dispelled these myths that were being put out about the German containers. I managed to get Edison to meet with that company. They flew their best people out from Germany to meet with them. After that, they quit bad-mouthing the product, because all the things they were saying, you know, they realized weren't true, you know. But they still went with the thin canisters, and they refused to allow the German company to bid the job.
Mm.
So, you know, so that's a problem. You know, one of the priorities for a decommissioning plant, we're kind of going all over here, but I'll just follow through on the story. If I ask the question or you ask the question, well, why would they pick? And in fact, the German company told them they would be competitive with the other bidders, even with the German product. Okay. So the question is, well, why did they not at least allow them to bid? You know what? Well, there's always only one answer for these companies. Profits, shareholder profits. That's what they're all about. Okay. And so I said, well, what was the reason that they would, you know, they'll give some BS reason, but what's the real reason they picked it? Well, when I analyzed all the competitors, they ended up picking Holtec. Actually, they first picked Areva Thin canisters, and then they switched and picked Holtec. They actually bought a bunch of the Areva canisters. They took delivery of them. They had a contract with Areva, and then they switched to Holtec. I mean, that's already money burned, you know. Why did they switch? Okay. So when I analyzed it, I found out that Holtec, they claimed that their canisters, that you could load hotter fuel in those canisters. And what that means is, if you can get it out of the pool, the fuel is in the pool when it comes out of the reactor and it stays there for a number of years and has to cool enough to before you can move it into the dry storage canisters. Well, they claimed that they could take hotter fuel than the other competitors. which meant Edison could get their pool empty sooner, and they could eliminate all their overhead costs, which are really high for maintaining those pools. They could get rid of the operators, you know. So, you know, it was just strictly, that was a money decision. Now, there's also some, you know, one of the other things about Holtec, and I can't prove any of this happened at San Onofre, but Holtec was found, one of the employees at Tennessee Valley Authority, who was responsible for selection of the canister for their reactors there, he admitted to taking a bribe from Holtec. And Holtec
and
lost
what happened
their
with set. Him? What happened when he did
well,
that?
Holtec had their they were stopped from buying any more getting any more federal contracts for a number of months. But then, because of this bribery thing, but then Holtec paid a fee to TVA. Millions of dollars, I forget the exact number. Millions of dollars to TVA. And magically, they got their approval again to get have federal business. So, you know, it wasn't called a fine. You know.
Magically.
And, yeah. Now there were.
This is the whole thing, isn't it? This is the hardest thing for me to understand. It's exactly the kind, same kind of story that's going on with the DAPL, the Dakota Pipeline, is that the residents of North Dakota rejected it because they said it would be a risk to their water. So they're forcing it on the Native Americans because of the money. It's the same thing. No, the NRC and the DO. I guess it's the Department of Energy. They will do anything for money. Is that as simple as it gets? As long as it makes a profit, they're willing to, like, stick with whatever thing that will destroy our planet?
Well, you know, the decisions, you know, you have to look high enough up in the chain. You know, the DOE is really just a puppet of higher levels, you know. And if you want to keep your job, you know, you're going to be loyal to your boss.
Wow.
And, you know, so, and you have a Senate and, you know, a House and a presidential administration. And so any one of those entities, especially the Senate, ends up having a whole lot of influence over what happens. So it's very important during an election to make sure those senators and you know, it helps to have the House also, but the Senate is especially influential. It's really important to elect the right senators and to work on your, you know, to work at the state level when you're picking your federal senators, that you get the right ones in there, you know. And then they also have to be educated, even if they have good intentions. People don't know about the issue that I'm talking about. These elected officials don't know. They're, you know, Dr. Singh, who's the head of Holtec, president of Holtec, owns it. It's a private company. It's not even on the stock market. I mean, he was telling the people in Vermont that these canisters would last 300 years, no problems.
Wow.
And he knows that's a lie. But that's what he told them in Vermont. And then the NRC tells people they'll last 100 years.
But they know that it's a lie, so they straight up will lie to the public?
Yeah. But they have a way of wording things to kind of, to skirt it, you know. And in fact, I have a video of Mark Lombard in front of our California Coastal Commission. It's on the homepage of San Onofre Safety. And it's a video where one of the California Coastal Commission, I educated the Coastal Commission staff about the problems with the canisters, because Edison needed a coastal permit in order to put more of these canisters in. And so I educated the Coastal Commission staff. And so when they wrote up their report to the commissioners that were going to make the decision, the Coastal Commission, they had the evidence in there that I'd given them, you know, about the fact they can't be inspected and blah, blah, you know, the things they've been talking about. So that was in their report, okay? And still, well, so and one of the commissioners, Schallenberger, she and Mark Lombard was there, you know, so he came out to this. And so he came up and made some bureaucratic statement that told him nothing. But Schallenberger had read the staff report. She called Mark Lombard back up to the podium and said, can these canisters be inspected? Point blank. And he, man, he tried, you can see how he does it and how he words things. And you can see the bob and weave, but she finally wouldn't. She just kept pushing and pushing and pushing until he finally admitted. And he says, well, it's not a now thing, he said.
Wow, how dare he even. Doesn't he understand that he is threatening all life on the West Coast? Does he not comprehend
West Coast, you're talking, you know, he's going to single-handedly destroy this whole country. I mean, you've got most of these things are on the East Coast, you know. You know, so this is not just California, and the winds blow east, you know. Oh. So, you know, it's...
They've been using storage canisters. We have about 10 minutes, and I want to get through this. I didn't ask you this, because we have aging nuclear facilities on the East Coast. Like, seriously, some of them are serious. Are they using these thin canisters, all of them? These old... is this where they're storing their waste? Is that why we're having issues there, because of these thin canisters?
No. I am not aware of any existing thin canister that has leaked, okay?
Right.
They have not, on San Onofre Safety homepage, I have a section, if you go down, there's a section called inventory, and it gives you the statistics, it gives you it by state, you know, how many canisters you have, how old they are, what type they are, if they're the thin ones or the thick ones, you know, so you can see exactly you know, what you have, but they haven't been loaded long enough to start cracking. So, you know, you need probably about 20 years before they're going to start not cracking, but leaking. They could be cracked right now, but nobody knows because they can't inspect them. And they will try and distract you by saying, well, we're working on inspection technology. Unfortunately, Commissioner Schallenberger didn't ask the follow-up question that I had asked in that technical meeting I listened into. Well, even if you could inspect it, then what are you going to do? She didn't ask that. Mm. And they gave them a coastal permit with conditions that they have to fix these problems in 20 years.
God damn.
Like, that's even possible. Yeah. And didn't even address the fact that they already have had them sitting there since 2003, existing ones. So, I mean, it was... So, you know, the politics, though, the Coastal Commission is basically their appointments by some of the legislature and most of them by the governor of the state. So, you know, getting up high enough on...
But this is really the core of the issue, though, Donna. We use these canisters at all the other reactors in the country. Is that...
Yeah, Prairie Island has the bolted lid ones.
So
there's one other that has some bolted lid ones, but
they're all
majority,
still thin, right?
Not the Prairie Island ones. The Prairie Island ones are about 10 inches thick with bolted lids.
So we have one nuclear facility that has relatively safe containment.
Well, there's a couple of others that have some of the thick ones, but then they, for their new ones, they're starting to buy the thin ones.
So so we have these thin ones, and they haven't started leaking, but we know that it's coming up soon. They're all 20, 30, 40 years old, right? So at some point in the next 15 to 20 years, we're going to have leaks going on at several of these facilities.
I would say it's more like the next 4 years.
Oh, my gosh. So this really is a sense of urgency. Do they have a sense of urgency under their feet to, like, figure this out before it starts becoming a catastrophic issue?
No. No, you know, the people that get put in management at the NRC, I mean, the ones that get the job, you know, they're the ones that play along, or, I don't know, they're delusional. I mean, I think it's like the difference. How do I explain it? I mean, you work with all kinds of people, right? Mm-hmm. Some people are smarter than others. Some are more delusional than others. So they pick the ones in management that they know they can, you know, that will go along.
Uh-huh. The people they push forward the ones that are the yes man and hold back
exactly.
The ones that actually have questions. But this is a point here because really this is actually big news when we think about it. Like, we're talking about less than 4 years, at least 80 nuclear facilities, correct?
Yeah, but... You know, we cannot say, no, there's closer to 100.
I know, but I mean, out of that, I'm picked 80 because that's kind of a low number, right? Out of 100.
Well, let's talk about what can cause the stainless steel to start corroding and cracking. Because there's two parts to this. One question is, we know they're susceptible. Okay, so the question is, when will they start cracking? And then how long will it take for that crack to go all the way through and cause the up through the wall for it to leak? Now, the susceptibility, now the NRC has clearly admitted that moist salt air will degrade the metal. Gee, who would have known moist salt air will degrade metal, right?
Right.
Okay, so that one they're admitting to, and I've got tons of evidence on that one where they're admitting it, okay? So tons of evidence. So anything that's around salt. Now, also you could have salt coming from a lot of these nuclear reactors put out steam. Anyway, there's sulfites. There's a number of different things. It could be... critters that can scratch the microscopic surface of these containers. So there's various things that can cause, you know, air pollution. There's various things that can cause the stainless steel to start to have corrosion and start the cracking process. Now, the NRC admitted to me November last year that they don't plan to do any research on any of those other causes. Mark Lombard admitted that after a whole lot of, pushback from me.
They're just going to ignore all that stuff. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, but we can't say for sure which ones have cracks or how far the cracks have grown because they have no way to know that.
Wow.
So we don't know. I can't say for sure at San Onofre that they're going to leak in 4 years because I don't know.
Yeah.
If they have cracks, for sure.
They could or could not. You know what, Donna? The time has escaped us. We're at 8:58. We have 48 seconds left.
Okay. Let me say one thing. So the new plan is to build consolidated interim sites to take these suspect canisters, move them to New Mexico or Texas, but they're the same canisters with the same problem. It's a horrible plan, and we need to push back on this. We need to use... This discussions about interim storage to ensure that they change the way they store waste in the United States, and it's a critical issue.
Okay,
and
well,
there's more information at San Onofre Safety.
Yes, please do go to sanonofresafety.org. Follow Donna on her Facebook page. Donna, I hope you come back. Thank you for being a friend of the show. We really appreciate your conversation. Put your courage feet on, everyone. Take action. Contact the NRC. Let's push back. We'll talk to you soon. Take care.
Okay, thank you.